Welcome, friends. Well done for getting here on time. Wonderful. I hope you've all had sufficient breakfast to feel nourished. And well done. Let's start as we mean to go on for the rest of the week, of arriving so promptly. Welcome to our first day of theme talks. Welcome to you who are here in person and to those friends who are joining us online. I can't see you, but hopefully you should be able to see me. So it's lovely that we have friends joining us online for these talks. As we celebrate the 30th birthday of summer school, let's just take a very brief moment just to settle ourselves, to prepare ourselves for being here together, ready to listen and share and sing and pray together. Let's hear the sound of the bell just for a few moments. Our opening words are adapted from a poem by Angel Deer. What a lovely name. What's breaking in the world right now isn't just politics, markets, or wars. It's the failure of the oversized, the empire-sized, the disconnected machines we were never meant to trust. Humans were made for the village, for the small circle, for relationships where we're known, not followed or marketed to, but truly seen in all our raw, messy authenticity. And all over the world, people are quietly gathering again, around fires, in community gardens, in circles under ancient trees, in prayer, in song, in silence. And we here together now can be such a space where greater vulnerability emerges, where honesty breaks through, where performances drop and something real begins to breathe again. We here together right now can create the space where people come not to be given answers, but to meet the living mystery inside themselves, to receive the direct revelation of their own truth, their own medicine. Small gatherings where wisdom is shared hand to hand and breath to breath, where grief is witnessed, where joy is not performed but lived, and where no algorithm decides who gets to be heard and what needs to be seen. It may not make the headlines, but may we feel in our bones that this is how the world is being woven back together. Big systems are breaking, but the village is remembering, and all of us here and now are part of this remembering. Words adapted from Angel Deer. And so may it be so in this gathering this morning. And I'm going to ask Lizzie to light our chalice. One small flame, representing all the flames that we each bring and which together can illumine the world. Thank you, Lizzie. Right now, we've got a story for all ages, and the young people are invited to help if they would like to. Yeah? Well, Molly, oh, that might be a bit tricky to include Molly. Now, I do, and there is a warning here, and dogs, humans with noise, we're going to have a bit of a storm. Yeah? Not quite yet, but at the appointed time, I've got some things that need rattling, and but I don't know whether I dare give them out quite yet. Right, you're going to get...
Not yet.
And who else? Thunder or rain? Thunder, okay.
Rain sick.
Would you like to be thunder? Again, not yet. Lay them down and listen to the story until I tell you. And dogs and Molly, be warned. She's looking anxious. She's got those eyes at me. There was once a man who wanted to know where God lived, which is fair enough, don't we all? Well, I certainly do. And he asked the people in his town, and they all gave different answers. Some said in the big church on the hill, others said in the synagogue, still others in the mosque, and some claimed that God lived high in the heavens. And none of these answers satisfied the man, so he decided he would go in search. And he travelled many miles, far from home, across the sea, and he saw many wonderful and strange sights. He visited great cathedrals and temples, and they were so beautiful and peaceful, and he thought, oh yes, I think I can feel God's presence here. But then on the steps outside, he'd see the homeless and hungry, and he thought, well, if God lived here, surely he wouldn't let all these people suffer. And the man was invited into people's homes, where families made offerings to household gods and goddesses. But he was confused because there were so many different gods and goddesses, and some people claimed that theirs was the best. One holy woman said that God lived in people's hearts. And he could believe this when someone was kind and generous, but for every kind person there was someone who was mean and cruel. And everyone had a different answer. And surely they couldn't all be right, could they? Finally, he thought, okay, I reckon maybe God can be found in nature. He'd always felt at home amongst the trees and the birds. So he built himself a little hut in the woods. And for a short while, he enjoyed the peace. Maybe at last, I found where God lives. But do you know what? He noticed the beautiful flowers he took pleasure in, they withered too soon. And then he noticed that the big animals killed the small animals. And he thought, oh, surely God wouldn't allow that. Perhaps God wasn't in nature after all. And after so many years of searching, he'd had enough. No closer to finding God, he took a ship across the seas and started the long walk home along the mountain pass that led to his village. It's okay, you're nearly on, folks. And would you know it, as the man walked, a terrible storm blew up. The lightning flashed, the rain poured. And the thunder roared. Brilliant. Okay, pause. Just pause. You'll have another go. And the man cried out to heavens, for pity's sake, God, if you're there, please stop this storm. But you know what? There was no answer. The lightning flashed. The rain poured, and the thunder roared. Oh, okay, yeah, thank you, wonderful storm makers. I knew this was going to be risky. But still no answer. The man soaked to the skin, edged round the cliff, fearing he'd be blown off the path, and cried out again, God, where are you? If you're real, prove it to me, help. And he turned the bend, this is where I need my husband. And suddenly he came across the entrance to a cave.
It's not a very exciting part.
Is it a man cave or a caveman? I don't know. And of course, now he had a cave he could take shelter in. But you know what? It didn't really do anything to improve his mood. He sank down into the dry floor of this warm cave, still feeling utterly miserable, thinking to himself, what a waste of time, all these years searching, and I'm still no closer to finding God. And you know, the more he thought about it, the more upset and angry he got. And he jumped up and he grabbed a sharp stone from the ground and he scratched some words into the cave wall. Hold steady, cave. I know, don't let go. Cool, these caves are not very stable when you need them to be. He did it a lot more angry than I'm doing it. I've got a wobbly cave here. Okay, what did he write? God is nowhere, he shouted to whoever in particular. And then he sank down into the cave floor and fell into a troubled sleep. When he woke, the rain had stopped and the sun was shining, but his heart was still heavy. And he travelled on his way, but just feeling still as despondent as before. Now, some weeks later, another man came walking along the same mountain pass, tapping with his stick and skillfully feeling his way along the rocks. He'd lost his sight, fighting as a soldier in a terrible war that had killed many people. With the battle over, he was on his way home, with only hope in his heart that his loved ones had survived. And of course, as he walked, what happened? The weather changed and a storm blew up. So it rained and it thundered. Yep. Well done. And the rain, with the path being slippery underhead, the man was in danger of falling. And he cried out, God, please guide my feet. But the rain kept pouring. Oh, pouring, yeah. The thunder kept thundering. Okay. And he cried out again, God, if you can hear me, please help. And as he turned the bend, his hand stumbled on a cave. Thanks be, it seemed his prayer had been answered, and here he could take shelter. And he walked inside, feeling his way along the walls. He was very good at with his sense of touch, and he deciphered some strange etchings in the cave wall. And curious, he, with his fingers, he spelt out some letters. G O D God I S is N O, W, now, H, E, R, E, God is now here. Yippee, God is now here. I am safe. And it seemed in that moment to be true. He'd found a place to rest until the storm had passed. And assured that God was with him, he fell into a restful sleep. And the next morning he woke with a glad heart. Down the mountains he went back to his home, singing as he went. So, who is right? God is nowhere. God is now here. And that, my friends, I think is what we're going to be exploring this week. And we'll all come to different conclusions. Perhaps it depends on the day we're having. I certainly have times when I think God's nowhere to be found, Other times it's easier to believe that God is now here when I'm with people like you, lovely people like you. So I invite you to ponder the question, is God nowhere or now here, as you go through the week? And keep your eyes and ears, hearts and minds open, and let me know. And thank you to our wonderful storm makers. And thank you to Caveman too. So we're going to have a hymn, number 233. Now it is quite an old hymn, and the Green Book. Yeah, sorry. It's a well-known to some of us, but others you may not have come across it. But I think it illustrates the whole thing about what do we mean by God. 233, sorry. Yeah, I think so, yeah. And the children will be leaving us during the hymn. And I haven't got a hymn book, so is there a spell? And please rise as you're able. To get us started on exploring the topic of finding our religion, we're going to hear from a number of different voices, just a sample of all the different viewpoints and experiences present in this room and online. And Jane has reached out to six people and asked what finding our religion invoked for them in the context of their own life and concerns, and what questions they might be bringing in relation to the theme. So we're going to hear briefly now from, in this order, and if you forget, don't worry, I've got the list, Tina, Andy, Rob, Emma, Judith via Zoom, and John. So over to you, Tina.
Hello, everyone. Hi. Thank you, Sheena, for a really fun story. I really enjoyed it. Okay. So I'm going to read what I've prepared for this talk. When I first heard this year's theme, I smiled. Finding our religion feels like a question I've been living into for years. It's not just theological. It's about how faith shows up in the messy, beautiful, as well as ordinary moments of life. Can I just check you can all hear me? Yeah, great, okay. So I grew up in a Hindu family, I'm still a Hindu, where religion was woven into daily life, and it still is. Hinduism is more than belief. It's cultural, relational, and deeply pantheistic. I was raised with the understanding that God is in everything and everyone. Later, I encountered Advaita Vedanta, a strand of Hindu philosophy that teaches non-duality, that everything is Brahman, the ultimate reality. It's not just that God is everywhere, it's that there is only God. Over time, this belief has become more people-centric for me. I married an Englishman, and he's not in this room right now, but... I'm so going to use that story and I'm so going to call him a caveman. anyway, he's not here, so I can say that. So yes, I married an Englishman who is an agnostic and a Unitarian, but he was raised as Church of England. And the story, our story, is we sought a spiritual home where we could both share. And that's how we found Unitarianism, a space where we could each be ourselves. A space where we could be together. A faith not bound by dogma, but open, inclusive, and really importantly, safe. Now serving in a Unitarian chapel with a strong community focus, I hold space for others through pastoral care, events, and a new provision for children and families. I'm not just organizing activities, I'm trying to embody something sacred, something that says you matter, you belong, and your story is part of something bigger. To me, being Unitarian in the 21st century means navigating the tension between freedom and commitment. But how do we also nurture depth? How do we nurture depth? And I've lost my place, bear with me. How do we... Sorry, shared language, that's a problem with looking at your phone. And a transformative practice. How do we move from a spiritual buffet to something truly nourishing? I'm bringing a few questions to summer school, and here they are. What does it mean to be unapologetically religious in a culture that often equates religion with rigidity or irrelevance? How can we reclaim ritual, symbol, and theological literacy without losing our openness? And lastly, what does spiritual formation look like for families and children in our tradition? And how can we make it joyful, accessible, and good, as well as rooted? I hope we'll explore religious identity, not as a label, but as a living, evolving commitment. One that helps us live well, love deeply, and act justly. I want our tradition to offer both sanctuary and provocation. A place to rest, a place to grow. I hope that we can explore this together with gratitude, with questions, and with hope. Thank you, everyone.
Thank you. Hi, folks, and can I just check that you can hear me as well? Fantastic, okay. Mine's a little different. That was wonderful, Tina, lovely, fantastic even. But mine is a bit odd, perhaps, in places. Despite being a minister, I am not as disciplined in my religious practice as I would like to be, not even in my supposedly regular meditation. And I'd love my practice, beyond Sunday worship, to have an identifiable Unitarian core. In reaching for this core, I wonder if Unitarianism should claim something that I have tentatively called neo-dissent. A big question for me is pinning down just what such neo-dissent might be. Dissenting against the dogmas of our time, such as neoliberalism, it might even call us back to gospel essentials. However, modern dogmas often present insidiously in ways that are difficult to argue with. Thus, someone speaks or acts in a fashion which needs challenging, but I am too slow, and the moment passes. This particularly happens if I want to give a complete, positive solution and find that I can't immediately do so. I am hoping that this idea of neo-dissent, which I'm very tentatively forming, might help me drop that and respond clearly. Sadly, a growing strand of oppression and injustice arising from capitalism regards artificial intelligence and technology. 21st century Unitarianism needs to not simply figure out how and when to use AI and other tech practically, but also to address the profound issues it raises philosophically and societally. In hope of a positive yet careful path forward, I have coined a word, techno-spiritual, that I would like to flesh out the meaning of in the context of future Unitarianism. However, I worry that we could instead increasingly be confronted with emanations from Silicon Valley that propagate the religion of the AI God to come. These ideas are part of my taking stock of what Unitarianism and what Unitarian endeavour might mean for me in the future. Still, notwithstanding how excited I can become about our movement, I've been quite buffeted by society over the last 5 years, and I increasingly need personal renewal. I'm nearly 3 years into a social transition as a non-binary trans woman that has had significant familial and, yes, some congregational challenges. While I knew I was heading into the storm when I came out, the wider backlash against trans people over the last 5 years has nevertheless been exhausting and reached a new intensity with April's Supreme Court ruling. However, the ruling also galvanised me, and hopefully there will soon be an LGBTQIA+ Unitarian group beginning to address campaigning, social support and worship needs. And an emerging idea from the planning of that is that we may be most effective campaigning in our religious niche. So for me then the question is, what is our religious niche? And finally, given wider events, there is a clear and increasing need for protest against, or at least witnessing of, how our society is in some ways at least failing. More personally, as part of my religious response, if it can possibly be part of my religious response, to anti-trans discrimination, how much do I want something as banal as the toilet to become an act of protest?
£15 from Superdrum. Many years ago, I happened to do the healer training in the NFSH, which was the National Federation of Spiritual Healers. Along with all the rather lovely woo-woo stuff, we had to write an assignment about the difference between spiritual and religious. Now, I'd always known from a young age that I was a religious person. I don't mean attached to a specific religion. I left my native Anglicanism in my 30s without any regret, really. But I felt life was innately a religious experience. And if religious freaks you out, then poetic or meaningful will do just as well. I was sort of baffled by people's belief that life owed them something. And they seemed really offended when it didn't arrive. So for me, being alive from a very young age was like being in a story. Now, the content often wasn't very easy because, well, to be honest, neither are stories very easy. Now, part of my story did involve believing in God, but I can't say I was particularly spiritual. Now, I was doing that healer training by accident because it was part of a diploma in Jungian psychotherapy, which actually included some sessions about the great British psychoanalyst and paediatrician Donald Winnicott. And I actually really fell for Winnicott. Now, if you know one thing about him, it might be his most famous idea, which is the good enough mother. She, and it could be he or they, it's simply the chief caregiver, is probably messy, is probably disorganised and not perfect, but has enough unself-conscious love and spontaneity to reliably respond to the slightest gesture, gaze, sound or smell that comes from their tiny infant. And by living within this loving authenticity of the parent's response, the infant begins the long process of discovering what Winnicott calls its true self. Our very sense of self is forged in relationship. Just as we are born human, but become a human person in relationship, so we are born with spiritual potential which will remain undeveloped or solipsistic unless nurtured consciously in the domain of the religious. Jesus likens this to salt not being used in the cooking or putting a light underneath a bucket. Our true self never stops developing because its aim is the eternal, the transcendent. So we need good enough, we need continuing relationship with the good enough God, if you like, spiritual power, if you like, but also the good enough community, the church, the sangha, to see and acknowledge the poetry and true meaning of each of our lives. Now, the way that many of the world's religions are practiced, unfortunately, results in what Winnicott called the false self, rather than the true self. And I guess many of us here and online may know this from experience. And that's why the Unitarian Church was invented. That's always been its function, to be a good enough religion, wholly dedicated to discovering and nurturing the true self in everyone. Now, friends, I think this is holy work. And I think the Divine Spirit, however you may conceive it, who is definitely good enough, loves us actually very much because of what we do.
I've been asked to think about finding our religion in the 21st century. For me, one way in was through weddings, especially marrying people from outside our congregation. In doing so, we invite the public into services that they might not otherwise attend. And at first, I wasn't sure that I cared for this. It felt like a distraction from supporting our congregation during a time of change. But when the weddings began, my view shifted. I realised that Unitarians can offer personalised ceremonies to all couples in love, especially those denied elsewhere because of faith background, sexuality, gender, or previous marriages. And so being part of that story with them has been a huge privilege. And I also noticed how fully couples and guests embraced the rituals, lighting candles in hope for the couple, in memory of those who are absent, or lighting the union candle. And these gestures are universal. They're freely offered, and they're deeply meaningful. So rituals matter. It marks significance in life without imposing belief. And for me, our religion is also about how to be with one another and what wisdom we can draw on to do that. And I feel really proud to be part of an intergenerational team at Mill Hill Chapel who support one another inside and outside of services. And we guide one another through challenges. So I find wisdom from them there. And in services, we draw wisdom from our Judeo-Christian traditions, from modern and postmodern poetry and music, from Mary Oliver to Kay Tempest, to Chopin, to beyond. And in our collective hope services, we share new songs, some personal poetry, family stories, and insights from many traditions. And so I find wisdom there. And I've also found a way to grieve better and to speak with others about grief. So recently, a school friend who has suffered a huge tragedy asked about church in a way that she hadn't before. And I spoke about how our chapel community helps me cope with uncertainty and sit with uncomfortable feelings and simply acknowledge them. And this denomination has helped me be okay with not knowing and with changing my mind, and sometimes that's daily. You know, speaking as a largely previously unchurched person, engaging in religion has helped me live more generously, think more deeply, and find a community that I was missing when I arrived in Leeds. Quiet acts, small choices, moments of silence, these have often been the most powerful. And I hope our movement continues to inspire creativity, flexible thinking, and space for silence. And at summer school, I hope to explore boundaries within freedom and tolerance. And I'm also interested in how we can sustain a church without burning anyone out. Can we value non-traditional roles more? Can we be intergenerationally co-created and evolve in ways that other religions can't? Can we speak firmly without risking offence? And how do we engage with what is happening in the world rather than become passive bystanders?
When I was 3 years old, God introduced himself to me as a father figure. It isn't really possible to describe except to say that I didn't need to ask who this being was. I just knew. Small children do. God has walked with me in that guise all my life. Unfortunately, I was sent to Sunday school at the age of 4 and became involved in religion. Having suffered for many years under the rigid yoke of Christian theology and leaders who were afraid to think outside of the box, wondering why the theological ends never tied up, I explored various Christian denominations. Without wishing to convert, I looked at Judaism. I saw much symbolism and much that was interesting in what I explored. but nothing compared to the living experience of my Father God. As I see it, religion is tied to a rigid belief system or set of rules, bringing separation and division, whereas spirituality is not. It is free. For me, spirituality is realizations that set me free from my human limited understandings and brings me life. As I left churches behind and discovered the Unitarians, I was a bit nonplussed at first, being among folk who didn't appear to have a clue what they believed. Then I came to appreciate my early life discoveries that it isn't about religion, but about relationship to God and about spirituality. To say that I am a Unitarian, a Christian, a Muslim, a Jew, a Hindu, or any other fixed standing, I find is limiting. I am, like everyone else, infinitely more than a religion, a particular take on life. That doesn't mean that these takes are invalid, just that they are partial and limited. I suppose our specific journey in this lifetime will dictate what we gravitate to. I see us as infinite beings having a season of limitation for reasons of learning and further progression into our spirituality. Although I couldn't truthfully say that I'm a Unitarian, I have found a place within Unitarianism, particularly within Unitarian Christian Association, that gives me freedom to roam and explore and to express my findings without the cries of heretic, burn the witch. It's a safe place to explore, think and be.
So when Jane asked me to write down and share some of the questions I've brought as a newcomer to summer school, I found myself yet again caught up in a very familiar struggle, you know, in my too much thinking, difficulty with words, all the usual suspects. But here are some of the questions that came up for me. What do I believe, and how much does that matter? Is being spiritual but not religious just an easy way for me to express my distaste for so much historical division, exclusion, and bloodshed? How clearly do I have to understand the divine? And then, when is taking theological and philosophical teaching from a wide range of sources a risk rather than a benefit? What are the dangers of a pick-and-mix approach to religion and for Unitarians in particular? And then, how truly autonomous are Unitarian congregations and individual members in matters of faith and belief? So there's a few. I would be amazed if I leave with definitive answers to any of them. I will be truly amazed. So after several years of being a member of a Unitarian congregation, decades of occasionally attending Quaker meetings, and a lifetime of skepticism, my religious evolution has been slow. However, I am now able to reconcile my rationalist thinking with an acceptance that we are all connected in a manner that I do not truly understand. And I do increasingly appreciate the power of coming together to explore these issues within a, wait for it, a church setting. Okay, so 26 years of recovery meetings has been really good training for me in the practical aspects of being part of a fellowship that exists to enable members to live a life based on spiritual principles. And this requires structure, commitment, discipline, as well as some honesty, open-mindedness, willingness, gratitude. You know, there's a long list of spiritual principles. You can add your own. So last year, as part of being part of the congregation at Essex Church, I wrote my first ever poem. And I'm so glad that the summer school program uses so many creative approaches to tackle the questions posed in finding our religion. Yeah, so, thank you so much for your music, your piano, because that connects me to something that I don't understand. So this poem, my first ever poem, was in the form of a haiku. And I tried to capture the traditional Japanese characteristics of three-phrase format. I did right. A contemplative tone and an emphasis on imagery over explanation. The subject of the poem relates to a small village churchyard in Sussex where my mother was buried, is buried. And on her headstone is inscribed her name, Patience Humphreys, the dates of her birth and death, born 1919, died 1953, and just three words. Her name, her date of death, birth and death, and just three words. So I'd like to finish by sharing the poem. Lichen-covered grave, inscription slowly fading, God is love remains.
Wow, so much rich contributions here. Thank you, all of you. Thank you, the six of you. And already we're beginning to see the diversity and the opposites and the contrasts. And we're going to be hearing a lot more of those contrasts, I think. Well, I've now got the privilege of talking for a bit longer, although I am mindful of time, so I'm going to try and sort of precis what I'm going to say. So bear with me if I roam around a bit. And I was going to give you all a chance to stretch, but mindful of the time, I think we might need to just wiggle in your chairs if you need to, you know, stretch, stand, yeah. And if at any point you do need to stand, obviously feel free. So to return to our story, is finding God the same as finding our religion? Well, obviously for some people, yes. But for other people, no, because you can be religious without believing in God. You can believe in God without being religious. And before we know it, we're getting caught up in all of those tangly questions. What do we mean by any of those terms? What do we mean by God and religious and spiritual? And it would be quite easy to spend the rest of my time just exploring that, but I'm not going to. You might be relieved to know. Instead, I'm going to offer some thoughts based on the title of this theme, Finding My Religion, by sharing a bit of my own story, because that's all of us Ultimately, we each have our own story, unique to us. And I hope that in hearing my story, you might gain fresh insight into your story, even if it's just to say, no, it's nothing like that for me. And whilst in my story, I use the word God a lot, just a reminder, Paul Tillich, I think, says it well. If the word God has not much meaning for you, translate it and speak of the depths of your life, the source of your being, of your ultimate concerns, and of what you take seriously without reservation. But before I say much about finding my religion, I need to tell you first about losing my religion, which brings us to that song by
R.E.M.
Now, most of you know, have heard of it, but Rob, I'm out in him, hadn't. So I don't know where he was in the 90s. So we're just going to hear a few verses if we can, and not the whole thing. We don't have time for the whole thing, but just to remind us of that classic. Really, you just prefer to listen to that than hear me waffle on. Well, that song, Michael Stipe says, is not about losing his religion, the songwriter, but about unrequited queer love, I think, or gay love. So, but maybe there's a similarity there. God is the absent lover who stops returning your calls. And the phrase, losing my religion, it's from the southern states of America, apparently, to describe that feeling when you're so fed up and frustrated, you've just had it up to here, you can't hold it together. And that, again, I think can have parallels with the spiritual religious search. And it certainly resonates with me, that song. I grew up in a household that was very religious from the outside. It was church three times on Sunday, grace at meals, prayers before bed, and a strict set of beliefs that told me who God was, how I could be saved, and how we should live. Yet, ironically, my family didn't think of themselves as religious, because as Pentecostals, there was a distinction made between religious people, it's false man-made doctrines, and true Christianity, which was about personal relationship with God. And this really puzzled me, because as I grew older and met people who were religious from other faiths, it seemed that we claimed not to be religious, but we had just as many man-made doctrines as they did. And I got to the point where I could no longer go along with the theology that divided people into religious or true Christian or false, true faith, saved or unsaved. And those song lyrics really resonate for that reason. That's me in the corner, in the spotlight, losing my religion. And I don't know if I can talk about it. And in this very sort of quite restricted church where questions were not invited. So I plucked up the courage to leave my religion and go in search, which took me up mountains and down valleys of the heart. And I examined one doctrine after another, a painful process over many years. But through it all, I never lost my belief that God, something existed and might be found, even though what I meant by that word underwent radical revision. And perhaps it's just in my DNA, that idea that some of us inherit the God gene, just as some of us inherit the music gene or the maths gene. And I come from a family of preachers, so it could have been that, or it could have just been nurture, the way you're raised. Who knows? But for whatever reason, the search drew me on. I lost my religion, but I was in search of a new one. And after a bit of a up and down route, the Anglicans for a while, the Quakers, through serendipitous means, I came across the Unitarian Chapel in Godalming. And what a sense of homecoming. I could get quite evangelical about it. This new religion saved me. Finally, a place where I could ask all those difficult questions, and it was okay. And not just my congregation. I attended summer school here in the late 90s and returned again and again hungry for that connection and affirmation and the sustenance it offered. And I look back with such gratitude to the people of those early years, people sadly no longer with us, Sheila Jones, Jean Mason, who showed such kindness in my wobbly moments, and inspirational guides like dear Simon John Barlow and David Monk, who expanded my spiritual horizons. And those of you who have been coming here a long time will remember some of these folk. And finding my religion was a bit like piecing together, not a jigsaw with a finite number of pieces that all slotted in neatly, but more like a mosaic, different bits here and there, which grew and changed. And it was hugely liberating, but it created the distance I needed to return back to my Christian roots. And there in the shards I thought I'd discarded, I found treasures, things actually of value. And new treasures amongst the liberal, universalistic, contemplative, mystical strands of the Judaic Christian tradition. It's not easy to do that, and I really don't want to make lighter struggles of others who, due to negative experiences, have left Christianity or whatever other faith they were raised in far behind. I know that many who come to our Unitarian churches struggle with religious language and get triggered by words like God and sin and salvation. And as a spiritual director, I accompany people who have had religious trauma. So I really get it, both personally and through other people that I work with. But I think that's one of the reasons why I want to reclaim the best of Christianity, because what I see far-right politicians claim, I want to say not in my name, not in Christ's name. And of course, it's not just Christianity that gets hijacked by fundamentalism. Let's not forget that. So for me, that return journey was important. And it can be summed up, I think, in a story from Sufi tradition about Nasruddin, the wise fool. The disciple's walking home late one night and he sees Nasruddin on his hands and knees searching for the key to his house. And the disciple says, oh, I'll help you look and see. So both of them are down on their hands and knees searching for this key. And another two disciples rock up and join in the search. And soon they're all just on the hands and knees under the street light trying to find this key. Some of you know what's coming. And no sign of it. And eventually one of the disciples pipes up, "Can you actually remember sort of roughly where you lost it?" And Nasruddin says, "Oh yes," waving his hand back towards the darkness, "over there in my house." And then the disciples jump up with astonished looks and say, "Then why on earth are you looking for it out here?" And he said, "Isn't it obvious? Because there's more light here than inside my house." And I think that's a bit like the faith journey. We lose the key to our true selves. And we might have lost it back in the past. And we go and search for it in other places out there where it seems more attractive or more enlightened. And that's an important part of the process. And I certainly visited other faith traditions which helped shed new light on my search. And I explored modules from offering Jewish, Hindu, Muslim, Buddhist and perspectives on Jesus. New light. But ultimately I had to return back to the place where I'd lost the key. Back in the dark house of Christianity. That's what I needed to do. It might be different for you. But we can take the light from other wisdom traditions back into our past. And similarly, the Zen Buddhist monk, Thich Nhat Hanh, explains how Westerners would come to Plum Village, often Christians who'd been wounded by the church, and they wanted to become Buddhists. And he'd welcome them in to sit, meditation, and find refuge in the Buddha. And then after a time, he said, "Go back home, make peace with your roots." Because he said, if a tree is severed from its roots, it can't survive. Suppose it's a bit like gardening. If you move a plant to a bigger pot, the poem is a bit like a poem by Charles Olson. Three lines. Whatever you have to say, leave the roots on, let them dangle, and the dirt, just to make clear where they come from. That's a bit like gardening. If you transplant a plant, put it in a pot, if you don't leave any of the soil on roots, it won't thrive. So that's why I went back, and that's why I'd encourage people to consider whether there's something in the tradition they've rejected. Not the whole thing, of course not the whole thing, but that might be of value to try and make a measure of peace. Not to go back to an abusive form of faith, a religion, but to see if there's something of value in what's been left behind. So that's what I've done, and for you it will be different. And I think another thing I would say is I think it's important in our spiritual growth to dig down deep into at least one core tradition, or maybe one or two, because to use another analogy, otherwise we're running all over the place trying to dig and draw on multiple wells, and we've become scattered. So that's why I choose to dig down into the core tradition for me, which is the Christian tradition, past all the stagnant water of dogma that accumulates on the surface. For you, it would be different. It might be the Buddhist or the Hindu or the humanist tradition. But one core tradition doesn't mean we can't draw on others. But go deep. Go deep. And some of you will say, well, shouldn't we be digging down into the Unitarian well? Not the Christian well or the Buddhist well or the humanist well. But, of course, what is the Unitarian well? Because we no longer have a single core well. And that's the dilemma why we're here today exploring this. It was much simpler 100 years ago. Unitarians, predominantly liberal Christian. You know that motto, fatherhood of God, brotherhood of man, leadership of Jesus, salvation by character, progress of mankind onwards and upwards forever. That's what it was. But it's not any longer. And many of us would say, thank goodness. But that makes it more complicated. So the questions I'm going to be asking is, what might be, is there a common well that we can all draw on? I'm going to be returning to this question. We might dig down into our individual wells, but is there a common well? And I'll be considering that in my last talk. I suppose we could say that our common well is more based on our values, the way we live our lives, deeds rather than creeds. That tends to unite us more than our theologies. So we can draw on that common well. But I'm wondering if there's something we can do theologically to draw on a common well And I'm going to park that question for now because time is moving swiftly on. But I think that's one of our greatest challenges. If we're all drawing from different wells, collectively, how do we promote ourselves? What do we say that we're about? But I'm going to park that question and just return briefly to the opening question. Is God nowhere or now here? And just offer a dream that the aeronautical designer J.W. Dunn once had, which might shed some light, give us a few clues. He was sitting on a hill overlooking a river, and on the other side there was a mass of people covered in shadow. And he was puzzled by the deep shadow contrasting with the sunlight where he was sitting. And then he realised, he says, that he got the sense that God was working with bent head on something of which I was ignorant, and the shadow of God lay upon the whole world. And Dunn in the dream was puzzled. If God's shadow's over the whole world, then why do they not see it? And then an angel in the dream pointed and said, look, God's shadow is... Sorry, Dunn said to the angel, if God's shadow is everywhere around them, why don't they see it? And I expected the reply from the angel to be that they're just too absorbed in their worldly affairs, just too busy. And Dunn had sympathy for those people. They're searching everywhere for God's existence. But the answer came, because it has no edges. And I found myself wide awake. What the angel said was true. It's psychologically impossible to be aware of anything which has no edges. To realise the existence of this or that, there must be a not this or not that to make comparisons. So there was no place in the whole world where God is absent, so it'd be useless to search anywhere for evidence of God. And when I heard those views, that dream, it started me awake. If the dream is right, perhaps we can say God is simultaneously nowhere and now here, everywhere. A bit like Tina, you were saying, God in everything, everything in God. God is the ocean, we're the tiny drops. God is the sky, we're the birds. God is the air we breathe. We can't find God because we're immersed in God. Maybe that could be something that, whatever, however we define God, that might be a uniting thing for Unitarians. Summed up by the Christian Hindu mystic Bede Griffiths. In every particle of matter, in every living thing, in every human being, in every situation, the one eternal spirit, always present. Is this somewhere we can put down collective roots and draw from a common well? I don't know. I'm asking questions and I don't have the answers. But that's sort of where I've arrived. So I'm going to park that now and allow time to settle. And we're going to hear some music, and you have time to reflect on what's been shared. And you have a post-it note. And on your post-it note, you're invited to write down anything that's bubbled up from whatever you've heard this morning. A word, a couple of words, a hope, a wish, a prayer, a challenge, a concern, anything you would like to put into a short time of collective prayer that we're going to have as we draw this session to a close. And we'll be gathering up the notes, I think, in a box. So, Nick, we'll have some music. Thank you. So we're not going to have time to read all these wonderful offerings out, but I think we're going to put them on the wall, the glass wall, so people can read them. But we are going to just hear from a few. So in a time of prayer, source of all life and love, known by many names, we give thanks for this community, for our time together, and all that we have shared. God in all things, help us find the best in ourselves and in each other this week. If we are all drawing from different wells, surely we should pass the chalice cup round and truly taste the wonders of other traditions. The edges are where we become aware of the presence of God. God really is nowhere for me, and that is okay. What does a religion without edges look like, and can it be a safe and healthy place of discovery? We ask for integrity and openness, and that society would stop looking for its key in the glaring light of prejudice, anger, and division. And as we move into the rest of our day, we ask a blessing on all that is yet to unfold, that we may find fresh insight, inspiration, challenge, and consolation. In the company of friends, opening ourselves to possibility, catching glimpses of a divinity now here, in everyone and everything we encounter. May it be so. Amen. So friends, let's sing our closing hymn together. This is number 30, Each Seeking Faith is Seeking Light, in the Purple Book. Thank you. closing words by Brother David Stendhal Rast. You, the one from whom on different paths all of us have come, to whom on different paths all of us are going, make strong in our hearts what unites us. Build bridges across all that divides us. United, make us rejoice in our diversity, at one in our witness to peace, a rainbow of your glory. May it be so. Amen. And to send us out, we're going to go out to a song, and if you need to leave straight away, that's absolutely fine, because I'm mindful we've got to get the room sorted for the next group. And do we need volunteers to help with chairs? Yeah, so we can do this as we listen to some music, but if you need to go, please feel free. Song by Carrie Newcomer. Great Wild Mercy. So when we're tired of all the rage, when we're tired of all the worry, when we're looking for some peace and we're trying not to hurry, let's lean into something absolutely sturdy, ready for a great wild mercy. So reclaiming that word mercy. There's a big wide sky filled with stars that feels so close but feels so far. It's news of the world, news of the heart, stories we claim and parcel and part. It will all unfold, the teller and the told. The stories that will heal us and the ones we let go. Let's lean into something absolutely sturdy, ready for a great wild mercy. And recorded song.
It was a summer storm that broke the heat. She had a blue umbrella as she stepped into the street. I saw her look up from beneath the brim. I'm better of it and closed it up again.